Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is The Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Yusef Danik for our first spooky episode of October. We discuss an underrated sequel, Exorcist 3. We touch on why it shouldn't be judged for being an Exorcist sequel, how close George C. Scott is to cracking the entire movie, and how Brad Dourif is creepy as hell. Exorcist 3 is a terrific horror movie, full of tension, and is well worth seeking out for some Halloween viewing. It was a great time talking about it with Yusef. On to the discussion. Hello, everyone. I'm here, back again, after a long extended vacation. Yusef Danik is joining me.
Hello, Robbie.
Don't do that. Don't do George C. Scott or a demon. I don't want either of those, frankly. Please don't give me either. Brad Dourif. I don't want Brad Dourif either.
You want any of those three things?
No, I don't want any of that. I just want you. I just want you, Mr. Yusef Danik. Yusef, how are you doing?
I'm okay. I'm a little sore.
Sore? From what?
Yeah, I spent the morning on the water. We were kayaking.
Oh, that's sweet. That's nice.
It was very lovely. We saw the mullet were jumping. And there were birds swimming.
Nature.
We were filled in the bosom of God's creation.
All right, good. Well, now let's forget about that because we're talking about Exorcist 3 today.
Yes.
We're doing a spooky October, spooky Halloween movies. I've never seen Exorcist 3. I've always heard about Exorcist 3 a lot, and I've always been intrigued by the idea of it. And we watch it and we're going to talk about it.
What did you hear about Exorcist 3?
Heard that it's underrated and you shouldn't dismiss it because of its title.
What was the title?
It's Exorcist 3. No, that's what I mean. Exorcist. I don't know. Have you ever seen Exorcist 2, Yusef?
I haven't. The Exorcist was so damn boring.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, you're already making enemies because there's going to be. I don't have strong feelings about the original Exorcist. I think it's like as a piece of craft. I think it's well executed. I think it's fine. There's lots of people who love The Exorcist and consider it like a perfect film.
So much walking and talking.
Yeah,
Mumblecore movie.
Sometimes, you know, walking, talking is okay, Yusef. I don't know what
I love boring. Don't get me wrong. I love boring, but like, ugh.
Okay. Regardless, I'm not talking about Exorcist. Yeah. I'm talking about Exorcist 2. Have you ever seen Exorcist 2?
I haven't seen The Exorcist 2. Is that the one that's the different one? That's like not like any of the others, or is that one of the Halloweens?
Exorcist, that's Halloween 3. You're thinking of Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is John Carpenter attempting to make Halloween into a anthology series where each Halloween would be different if he failed. And Halloween returned to being Michael Myers movies every single year. Exorcist 2 is terrible. Yes, it's a terrible film. And that's why I mean overlook the title of Exorcist 3, because you would go, oh, well, Exorcist 2 was terrible. Why would I say Exorcist 3? It's just another bad sequel.
Is it that the odd-numbered Exorcist movies are the good ones? I think I heard that somewhere.
No, 4 and 5 are also bad. So you don't need to see either of... Or they're not... They're like one of them... Both are... One of them is a prequel, I think. And the other one is... I don't know. I don't know what they are.
Was it like about a baby demon?
That's like what you asked me a question, Yusef. Stop asking me questions that I haven't answered your first question yet.
I'm sorry.
Your first question was, what did I hear about Exorcist 3? I heard it was underrated and that it shouldn't be dismissed because it's the third sequel to The Exorcist.
Oh, well, it's the second
sequel. Second sequel, third movie.
It's like we're in the 22nd century.
Mm-hmm,
Is it the 22nd century?
No, we're in the 21st.
Is it?
Yeah.
Still?
Yeah, still. We're not seeing. You and I are not going to see the 22nd century unless there's like miracles of science happen.
Oh, you know what? I'm okay with that.
I'm not living 115. I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
And I texted you
Yes.
After about like 15 minutes of when I started watching the movie, and I said, I already love this movie.
Yes. I recall the text. It was a strict violation of our no jazz before the rumble policy, but I'll allow it.
There's no policy. What are you talking about? We don't have that. I don't have that policy.
No jazz before the rumble.
I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, that's because you're just a dirty soch.
What? What words are you? Are your children, your school children, your wards? Are they the ones teaching you this slang?
They tell me about the things. But I know I'm cool now. Okay. I'm cool. Finally, I figured it out.
Okay, good. I love Exorcist 3. This movie is great. I love it.
It is.
Podcast over. We're done.
Enthusiastically interrupted you because I agreed with you. I felt an emotion.
I think this movie is great. I watched it twice. I rewatched it, which I generally don't do so soon. But I rewatched it like two nights after I watched it the first night, because I liked it so much. This is going to be my yearly scary movie rotation, I think.
Yeah. What else is in the rotation?
The Thing, of course.
Yeah.
Frighteners.
Oh, yeah, with the Michael J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox. Love the Frighteners.
That's a good movie.
Frighteners is great. I love Frighteners. It's my favorite Peter Jackson movie.
Oh, he wrote that?
He directed it. He made it. I don't know if he wrote it or not, but he did direct it.
That's good.
But I love the Frighteners. Trying to remember. What other?
Practical Magic?
No. That's also not a horror movie, but.
Oh. Well, it's just a good, fun October movie.
Descent.
Huh? The Scent of a Woman?
Descent.
Descent.
Or The Descent. I forget if it's The.
Oh, is that that movie that we watched?
Yes, it is.
And then we ate cookies.
Slither.
So many cookies.
Slither and The Descent. Both those films we watched are both in my rotation as well. They're rewatchable. They're fun. And they're like, they have a lot of, I don't know, just a good combination of not just the scares, but also like character, and it's good that they vary between each other. I think that's another contingent point. Like, they can't all be the same type of movie. I want them to be different from each other to a certain degree. But I think this enters that rotation. It exceeded my expectations. Did you have any expectations, Issa?
I really did not like The Exorcist, and I really never thought about The Exorcist 2, so no, I had no expectations, although I was instantly delighted when I saw George C. Scott on screen.
He is the only character in this movie. There's no one else.
There's no one else. He's chewing that scenery. That's an acting thing, right?
Oh my god!
Does he chew the scenery?
Yes, absolutely. I think there are those moments in this film where, like, George C. Scott plays. I don't know if you remember this because you hated the original Exorcist, but the Lieutenant Kinderman is in Exorcist.
Oh, and he see you in that.
George C. Scott does not play Kinderman in the original Exorcist.
Oh,
the actor
did a switcheroo.
Well, the actor passed, so he couldn't. He could not reprise the role.
He got ate up by Satan.
I don't think Satan had anything to do with it. But
you sure?
Yeah, I'm positive. But they switch the focus onto this Lieutenant Kinderman, who is played by George C. Scott, and you say he chews up the scenery, and he does. There are scenes where he's just like going crazy, over the top, yelling, screaming. But that, I think doesn't necessarily tell you the complete truth, because there are also scenes where it's very understated, very dry, very human, very plain.
I would agree with that. I enjoyed all of it. It was fun, procedural devil movie.
Devil movie?
It's a devil movie, right?
Does the devil actually make an appearance?
I mean, I imagine this is a lot like Conversations with Andre or My Dinner with the Giant or whatever that movie is, where they're just talking.
Yeah, have you not seen My Dinner with Andre?
No.
Why not?
What happens?
They talk. Yeah,
right?
They talk.
That's
yeah.
all they do. They just talk.
I mean, that's all they do. It is the vast majority of the film. It is talking, but it's not. It's good. It's very well written. It's
a lot of people seem to like it.
I like it for what it is. I'm not gonna, if I'm looking for like a rollicking good time in the movie theater, I'm not gonna go watch My Dinner with Andre. But if I kind of want something that I want to like watch and just have nice dialogue wash over me, it's certainly one of those. And I think this film, for a lot of it, has that same kind of feel. Frankly, it's written by William Peter Blatty, who wrote the first Exorcist film.
Yes.
And it's also directed by William Peter Blatty.
Didn't William Peter Blatty write the book?
He did. He wrote both the first Exorcist novel, and he wrote Legion, which is what this is based on.
Oh. So he wrote the book, then he made the movie, then he wrote another book.
He didn't direct the first Exorcist. William Friedkin directed the first Exorcist. It is William Friedkin. They had the same first name. That was like, they had the same first name, so it confused me. But Friedkin directed the first film, and he was going to direct this, then kind of decided not to.
Who directed the second one?
Are you familiar with the film Zardoz?
I am.
The director of Zardoz directed the second film.
Before or after directing Mr. Connery?
It's after. It is, I believe. Yeah.
After?
Yeah.
Oh, he was riding high on that Zardoz.
John Borman directed Exorcist 2.
Okay.
Is John Borman's The Exorcist 2, The Heretic.
That's a great title.
It actually was the next thing he did after Zardoz.
Well, I imagine directing Sean Connery, especially in that outfit, is beyond psychically disorienting.
He directed Deliverance, and then Zardoz, and then Exorcist 2.
Oh, God. Could you imagine, like being in his immediate family during this time period?
He would just be a maniac. Who, John Borman?
Yeah.
Yeah. But William Peter Blatty directed Exorcist 3 and wrote Exorcist 3. And I think that the fact that the film is so kind of, I don't want to use the word dry because I don't think that's accurate, but plain.
Yeah. It doesn't get all mucked up. It's boring in the right places and action-y in the right places.
We're going to talk about that.
Talking. I like it.
We're going to talk about the action, but I mean, the majority of the film is just dialogue. And that does not make the film like boring or dry or it is a horror film. It is tense. It evokes that tightness in my chest, the pleasant tightness, like, oh, what's going to happen? This is bad, but I enjoy it.
Nice.
But George C. Scott is the only real character.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it.
Like
I think cigarettes were another character.
I mean, he is friends with Father Dyer, and I think their relationship is the kind of like impetus to drives the rest of the film after Father Dyer is killed.
Yeah. They were buds. They went and they had lunch together all the time.
And they saw It's a Wonderful Life?
Yeah, that was weird.
Why? Why is it weird?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's a pretty decent movie.
I mean, I don't like It's a Wonderful Life, but I feel like it's a perfectly valid film to go see with your best friend every year on the anniversary of your friends.
I like
their mutual
friends.
Their mutual friend's death.
Yeah, no, that's nice. That's a nice thing. And I mean, It's a Wonderful Life. It's not a bad movie.
It's a little corny. I think that's if you're gonna have a criticism of it, it's a little corny. It's a little bit. I think it's just because it's played every year. You know, it's like, oh, it's a Christmas film. You're like, okay, sure it is.
No, I mean, it's a suicide banking film is what it is.
Is that how you think of it?
Yeah.
Okay. But George C. Scott has to carry the movie.
Yes.
No one, like, he has everything on him. Like, there's Brad Dourif and Jason Miller, their duel, they both play the killer.
Yeah.
But they're not, like, how many scenes, like, two scenes, three scenes?
Yeah. And it was fine. That was like an appropriate amount. I never felt like it was bogged down with like too much explaining and too much procedure. It was like they kept it kind of simple and it was just enjoyable. I enjoyed myself. It was compelling. I was scared in the right places. There was good. It was like a real nice, like it was like a spooky Law and Order.
I mean, it's different from the original Exorcist. And in that it is focusing more, it is like a procedural. It reminds me so much of Fincher. It reminds me of Seven and of Zodiac.
Yeah.
Which is appropriate because there's a Gemini killer in this.
Yes.
And apparently Jeffrey Dahmer loved this film, which is disconcerting, but.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you make a movie like this. Obviously some people are going to like it in a way that is, you know,
not good.
I mean,
bad.
Well, yeah. I mean, but like, yeah. I mean, I was literally seconds away from saying, "Well, people have their good points," but a good thing I didn't say that because that would have been wrong.
That would have been wrong. But I like David Fincher. I like his films, even though they are, you know, they have their. I think they have their issues, but I like that the takes on this. It reminds me foremost of Seven because I feel like both the films are thematically similar in a lot of ways. And it makes me wonder if Fincher had seen this and was if this was an influence on him.
Yeah, I could see that. Okay, so I just looked this up. This came out in 1990?
Yes.
This does not feel like 1990.
What does it feel like?
It feels like 1983.
Is that good or bad?
That's great.
Okay.
That's the best. That's a good time to be a movie.
What's wrong with 1990?
I don't know, man. Well, it seems like Christopher Columbus directed a lot of those movies.
Who? What?
Wasn't that a production company? Christopher Columbus? Columbus?
Columbus Pictures?
I don't know.
It's Columbia. It's Columbia. It's not Columbus. But I mean, Goodfellas came out in 1990. Home Alone came out in 1990.
I guess, yeah. I mean, 1990's fine. 90's fine. 91, we're starting to get into
Tremors came out in 1990.
Okay, Tremors is real good.
Tremors is great.
I love that movie.
Tremors is great. 1990's was a great year for film. But
it doesn't feel like the 90s, though.
It doesn't. It does not feel like a 90s film. But I mean, I feel like that's the influence of when the book was written and the fact that it is. I mean, it takes place 15 years after the original Exorcist. They place it.
Yeah.
Because they say, yeah, like it is connected to the original Exorcist in that way. In that Kinderman, the cop, the lieutenant played by George C. Scott, is investigating murders that are similar to the Gemini killer murders. The Gemini killer was caught and executed 15 years prior to the setting of the film and executed on the same night as the exorcism of the original exorcist took place, which killed the priest in the exorcist. Father Karras, whose role is reprised by Jason Miller in this film. Although you don't know that for 75-80% of the film.
Yeah.
You're just lost.
Which was nice too. It was nice to be on a journey.
I mean, I think that I think originally this was not going to be titled Exorcist 3.
What was it? Was it just going to be like The Priest Killer?
No, Legion was the title. It's just going to be the same title as the book.
Oh. I suppose. I think it's better as Exorcist 3.
I don't know. I kind of like the idea that it's just Legion and then you get that connection much later on. Like, oh, wait, this is like if you know, the detectives like vague, like it references that stuff. But you don't really need to know about the Exorcist to know what's happening in this. I think like the performances sell it. They explain everything I think you need to know. It's not like, what's her face isn't in this at all. They mention a little girl, but
does Linda Blair eat it at the end of The Exorcist, or does she make it out okay?
She's an exorcist, too. I don't remember. She's completely fine.
Oh, she's an exorcist, too.
Yeah, it's terrible. Do not watch.
She
does not die. She's fine.
She's fine.
She's Damien. Fine. What are you doing? Are we just referencing every demonic movie?
No, isn't Damien a character in The Exorcist?
What?
I thought he was the boy.
That's The Omen. What are you doing? Are you okay? Have you ever actually seen The Exorcist?
I believe I have.
Have you seen The Omen? Did you see The Omen and think that was The Exorcist?
Is The Omen about the boy?
Yes, The Omen's about the boy. There's also Rosemary's Baby.
The Exorcist is about the girl.
Yes. It's about a possessed girl.
Yes.
And her family and trying to deal with this family falling apart in the face of evil.
Okay. Exorcist, kid sister, Omen, my buddy. Got it.
I don't know what you're doing.
I'm keeping things straight. I'm a professional. I use mnemonic devices, Robbie.
Okay, fair enough. I'm just checking on you.
It's in my memory palace now.
Okay. But George C. Scott has to, his performance carries the film. He carries us through the film. Everything we discover, like he is, you know, it's a procedural in a way that he's trying to solve these crimes, and he's the head lieutenant, and he's just trying to figure out what's going on, and he's driven. He's also struggling. He's not like a
Sherlock Holmes.
He is just
making it happen.
He's on the edge of a nervous breakdown in every scene.
I imagine I imagine his ulcers are organ sized.
His ulcers have ulcers?
He just seems like what do you think his diet is like on a day-to-day basis? Like, how much Senka does he consume?
What's Senka?
It's like instant coffee.
Oh, okay. Probably a lot. I imagine lots of coffee.
Give me a Senka!
Ah! Coffee!
Yeah. I imagine, this is right before... The 90s were going to be very hard for this character because of the emphasis on sort of more artisanal coffee. He would probably have hated that.
Coffee! Burnt toast!
Yeah, exactly. They need to taste exactly the same.
No butter!
Oh, God. Oh! Oh! Yeah, no, you're right, though. He is... Yeah, no, he is tense.
And he's... But he's also... He's trying to do the right thing.
Yeah.
He's a smart guy, too. He's trying his best.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. I'm rooting for Kinnerman. I'm rooting for him. I like him.
Yes.
Like, it's not... This is not like, oh, he is the compelling but not, kind character. Because you see him he wants to do the best for people. He wants to solve crimes. And yet he is that kind of... burnt out, almost not quite nihilistic, but very like especially in contrast to Father Dyer.
Yeah, well, but he wasn't so like over the top with it. That was like the most muted thing about his character, because it's not like he's like, oh, the world is a scum bucket and I'm gonna, you know, like, I don't know. He doesn't seem like he is like too burnt out. Like it's just there is a malaise. There is tension, there is stress, but it's not like it's, I don't think it's gotten to him completely, but it is slowly killing him.
Well, you can see it. Father Dyer is like, before he gets killed, is like that. He's like, no, everything, he believes in God. He is,
yes.
He has complete faith in God, in the fact that at the end of all things, when we all die, everything will work out. God has a plan, and there is good in the world, and we can have faith in that. And Kinderman doesn't have faith in that. Would you say Kinderman's an atheist?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Which, I love that. But he's also not like, he's not like an annoying atheist. You know, where he's like, you know, like morally superior about it. He's just like, wow, this is what I don't believe in, blah, 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 blah. It's fine. Like, he is an inspirational atheist. Like, he doesn't need to convince anyone of anything. So that's nice.
I think it's just their relationship is like, it's the humanity that we get. I think it's the primary source of humanity we get in the movie. It's like their banter back and forth. It's very like, it's like old married couple banter.
Yeah. Like, no, it reminds me of a time that maybe never existed, wherein people could hold different views and coexist without destroying each other.
And it's like, I think that banter back and forth, it's again a reminder that this is a writer directed this film.
Yeah. Yep.
You get those scenes where they're in the bar and Larry King is there for some reason.
Was Larry King in the movie?
Yeah, they have a cutaway very quickly in the bar scene when they're talking.
What?
And he's telling, and he also, it's like a terrible, where Father R is like, yeah, everything will work out. And then Kinderman's like, he tells him how the boy got murdered. He's like, oh yes, they cut off his head and then replaced his head with the head from a statue of Christ done up in blackface. And as he had ingots driven into his eyes. And Father Dyer's like, oh no. He's like visibly shaken by this horrific thing that happened. And right in the middle of that scene, there's a quick cutaway to other people at the bar, and Larry King is just sitting there.
Walla Walla Washington, go.
Kind of. It's just very quick. It's just like, hey, I think it's like probably William Peter Blatty is friends with Larry, or was friends with Larry King. And they're just like,
Did you spot Fabio in the dream sequence?
There is a lot of famous people in that dream sequence.
I love it. I don't know how, maybe these people just really love The Exorcist.
There's Patrick Ewing is in there.
Is that the basketball man?
The basketball man, Patrick Ewing, at that time was young and a star. Fabio, Samuel L. Jackson is
really?
In that. He is sitting there. His voice is dubbed over, and he's wearing headphones. But he says,
"That's odd that you would dub over Samuel L. Jackson."
I mean, this is way before Pulp Fiction, way before Samuel L. Jackson was a star. But it is Samuel L. Jackson. He says, "The living are dead, or deaf, nice. Maybe I forget if it's dead or deaf. I think the living are deaf. That might be more accurate. I don't know." But the little boy is there, and George C. Scott's like, I'm sorry you got killed. I'm sorry you were murdered, little boy.
Yeah.
He's got the scars on his neck from when his head got removed, and it's really disconcerting. It's really, really strange, especially considering all the rest of this film is very, until the very end, is that kind of very realistic, very grounded. And then suddenly there's this dream sequence and Patrick Ewing is there wearing big angel wings. Fabio is there. And there's this little boy.
Those angel wings were real distracting.
I mean, it's on purpose. I'm fairly certain that's all intentional. Like, it's supposed to be like, this is absolutely crazy. Definitely not real.
Yeah. I didn't hate the dream sequence because it definitely was a dream sequence, right?
Yes, it's definitely a dream.
Not like it was a vision or something.
No, and I think that's the fact that I don't think Kinderman's like, oh yeah, I really saw. I mean, it puts us in that mindset where he's like having dreams of seeing this dead child. And
I like that he didn't solve it because of his dream, though. That would have been terrible.
I mean, he doesn't solve anything. I'm gonna make that very clear. He doesn't like
he kind of pieces it together, sort of.
He pieces together.
The paperwork on this is going to be a nightmare.
Well, he pieces together like the obvious. Like, no, these are the only the Gemini killer could have done the, or someone who was very close to the Gemini killer could have done these murders, because they know specific things that no one else knew. Only the detectives that worked on the case knew it, and
yeah.
The killer
not
himself.
On his hand.
It's not. Face, it's in his left. This hand, not the right, but the left. Like, he's just, and again, George C. Scott yelling about.
Yeah.
Till the
which it was appropriate yelling.
It is.
It was totally the right time to fly off the handle.
Hospital administrator, you can't. What are you doing? You can't do this. You can't lock down a hospital. It's like, someone's. They know it. And he's like trying to hold everything together because of the fact that his best friend just got brutally murdered.
Was this before or after the exsanguination?
This is right after. So, and this is him. This, because he we're going to talk about the scene where he goes into the hospital and for the after Father Dyer is killed. It is my because it's my favorite scene in this movie. Yeah. But yeah, he's like screaming about and like he and I think that's a, it's not that this because the case is basically unsolvable.
Yeah.
And I think that's a part of the film. It's a part of the theme in that, like, it's not really like the first film is more about, I don't know. I think it's loosely connected to those themes of faith in it, not just faith in God, but faith in institutions. And in the first film, it is the characters, they appeal to the church for help primarily and to medicine. They try and go to a psychologist and then, and poor Reagan is like putting in the electro shock therapy and like you get 70s medical technology, which is its own kind of
Spinal Tap. That's Spinal Tap, man. I do remember that.
Yeah, that's the worst thing in the movie to me in the original Exorcist is all the 70s medical technology. They're like, yeah, this will fix her. I'm like, no, it won't. Oh my God. But there is this like the police, the medicine, church, like it's again, it's just all these institutions. They are confronted with this killer and these crimes. What can they do?
They can rely on a faithless, burnt out detective.
I mean,
to speak to Satan.
I mean, it's very much like that. And let's get to that scene. Because it is basically just exactly it. I think it is the perfect distillation of the theme of the film, where we get we have because this is when Kinderman has that dream, because he has the dream, he's walking through this weird hospital. It's like basically I think it's supposed to be like a receiving area for heaven, and you have all these angels talking to people.
It looked like a train station.
Yeah, it looked like a train station. And you have all these angels, and one's Fabio is an angel, and Patrick Ewing is an angel. And they're talking to everyone. They're like, hey, you're dead. Let's talk. And then...
That's my favorite talk show.
Hey, you're dead. Let's talk. And we're about to go to heaven. We're going to brief you a little bit, okay? This is what it's like up here. And then he talks to a little boy. And then at the very end of the dream sequence, he sees Father Dyer, who also has his head sewn back on, just like the kid does. And George C. Scott's, well, at least, he's like, oh, he's like, and even in the dream, he's like, this is a dream. He knows this isn't real. But then he sees Father Dyer there. He's like, why are you here? This is only for dead people. And Father Dyer's like, well, that's, yeah, I know. And he wakes up to a phone call informing him that Father Dyer has been killed. Early in the morning, between 5 and 6 a.m., between nurse visits.
Yes.
And that scene right then, we wake up, we hear a still shot, an establishing shot of the house, of his house, and he answers the phone. He's like, and he whispers, you know, he's like, and that is even more impactful because of him snarling and screaming half the movie. When he's whispering, he's like, what are you telling me? You know, it's like Father Dyer, who was in the hospital for unrelated medical problem, is brutally murdered, and we walk in to the hospital from Kinderman's perspective. The camera is, we are in Kinderman's head literally, and he walks in and everyone is just staring at him, all the cops especially, because they all know him and they all know him, his relationship with Dyer.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, and they know he's going to fly off the handle. He's going to lose it.
They're all looking. They're all staring at him, waiting for like, what is he going to do?
Yeah, smashing of things.
Well, is he going to lose it? Like he's already on the edge, and like, is he just going to completely break down? Like they don't know, and they're so worried about it. And all the police officers are just staring at him. All the nurses are like, kind of leaning away from it. Everyone's kind of leaning away from him. And he walks into the room and we see him look at the body, like even knowing that it's his best friend, he still looks right at the body, goes to the hands, like he takes his job comes first.
Yeah,
I love it. Looks at the hands and I the shot of like of him of them. They it's like the shot is from like above, mm-hmm. and the other two detectives are in there, and there's a certain point he's like, what are the there's just these array of bottles on the side.
Yes.
Medical bottles with a screw cap, neatly laid out, symmetrical. I think it's like 5x10 or something, or 5x8, whatever it is. And it's just neat and nice. And you're immediately like, what's that? And we are told, you know, we don't know what they are. No more than Kindernan himself knows.
Yeah, it's the sort of thing you might lead with. Like, oh, by the way, this is what this lovely display is.
Well, they don't tell you right away. You know, they're like, and they it's shot plainly and shown us. We're like, it's right mm-hmm. there. And we just saw the room the prior day because they visited him. Kinderman visited Dyer, and Dyer was reading the ladies' fashion or something instead of he was reading like a ladies' fashion magazine, which I loved.
Yes.
He makes a joke about it. But there was no bottles there then. Why all these bottles? What are they what's going on? And then Kinderman asks, he's like, what are these bottles? And the detective's like, it's his blood. And all of it. All of his blood.
Which, I mean, they explain how he does it later mm-hmm. on.
Yep.
That is a feat.
It is. Well, I mean, we'll talk about the demon. We'll talk about the patient X. But he's proud of it, to be fair.
He's, you know, honestly, it's ghoulish and monstrous, but it is a technical feat.
It is a feat. And
well done.
I just love that one moment where he's like, it's his blood, all of his blood. And there's not a drop spilled. There's not even a smudge on the caps. And, you know, I think as an audience, you know, like, okay, this is The Exorcist 3. There's supernatural stuff going on, theoretically. You know, there's demons or something happening. But yeah. Kinderman doesn't know that. He's just a cop. And he just stares and sits and just everyone's quiet, and the camera just sits there and just lingers. And it is just like, how do we, not just the police, but how, I mean, it's certainly a part of it, but it's like, how does humanity reckon with this? When you're confronted by this, confronted by something that will kill someone, chop off their head, replace it with a statue of Christ, and remove all of the person's blood without spilling a drop, how do we reckon with that?
It is a pickle.
You can't.
No. Much respect.
It's not even just like, well, one, it is like theoretically, how does someone do this? Two, why would someone do this? And three, like, it's an existential question of like, well, I have to exist on a world where this is a thing that takes place, where there's a capacity for this on Earth. In our world, we can do this. Someone could do this. Can't, like, not just that they can technically do it, like literally are able to, but even that they could choose to do such a terrible, horrible, disgusting, monstrous thing. And it just lingers there and just lets that sit. And it's just like, oh, it's just like heavy and awful. I love it.
The movie is... Even though it has the sort of bonkers bananas climax at the end, even that's not too much. Like, nothing about this movie is too much, which is nice.
Well, and I was going to mention, there's almost no gore in this at all.
Yeah, it's very clean. Very clean film.
You see a little bit of blood, like, here and there.
Mostly blood comes out of statues.
Yeah, you get it, and you get it earlier in the film. There's like some blood trickling onto screen after the priest gets killed off screen. Mm-hmm. We only hear the killer. We hear the old lady voice on the side of the confession booth.
Yes,
which, oh God,
yeah, that's bad news.
The old lady voice. I killed him. Like, it's just like, oh, God. Ugh. We don't see anything again.
You know, the sound in this movie is great.
It's really just good.
From the voices, like the subtle, like, voice modulation on the demon that, like, changes in intensity. And just, like, just the sound design in general. Like, there are just so many moments where I was like, oh, this movie just sounds good. It's a little weird that, again, it was made in or released in 1990, like that. It doesn't sound like a film from 1990, which is nice. That's a compliment, because I feel like it wouldn't have sounded good.
Just the It's just this noise, just this drone, this awful, evil sounding drone, just occasionally, just as like,
yeah.
And you're like, oh God, what's happening?
Yeah, this movie sounds great.
It's really good. And it's like, and again, those moments work because it doesn't go crazy with him. It doesn't go overboard. It's very
well,
like,
when he's talking to the devil, it's like, oh, his voice is a little different, but it's not like too different where it's like, oh, that is too much.
No, it just,
you know, I long for the days when Satan was subtle.
It's just a gentle, it's like deepening. It just goes, oh, those are the moments. Like, it's just those, it's just enough to highlight it. And it just,
yeah,
a little bit of
and
pop.
And
then
like a little pitch shifting,
mm-hmm.
You know, and like a little harmonizing effect, but it's like very tasteful. Like, good job, everybody.
Good job.
And tasteful sound design is not a thing you think of when you think of like 80s horror movies.
1990. Thank you very much.
Yeah, 1990. Made it probably in 1989.
I mean, yeah, I think that, I mean, this film had a lot. We're going to talk about some of the production things because it's going to tie into the finale, the final scene of the film. But
did they run out of money?
They went over budget. They did not run out of money. They went over budget because of the reshoots, which we're going to talk about. There's reshoots, extensive reshoots in the film, which we're going to, might affect your, that's, I watched the, there is a director's cut available out there.
Oh, I watched the first one. That
yeah. The theatrical was, version.
I don't know. I watched the first one that I clicked on Amazon Prime.
Yeah. That's the theatrical version.
Oh, okay. So I should go watch the director's cut.
You probably know. I've seen parts of the director's cut and we're going to, well, I'm going to tell you about it, Yousef, and we'll decide if you really, you can decide if you really want to see the director's cut or not. It's also not using, it uses unmastered footage and raw stuff.
Weird.
So it doesn't, that's all they could recover.
What is it, deleted scenes?
That's all they could recover. They couldn't, a lot of it was lost.
I'm sorry, but no, that's unacceptable. That is not becoming of William Peter Blatty's.
It's not his fault. It's the studio's fault. We're going to talk about that too. See, there's so much.
Cut.
There's so much to talk about this film. I love it. It makes me very happy. Sound design's great. There's not a lot of gore until we get to the finale, but I think we should segment our finale discussion off. But that, I love that scene. And there, we don't see the reveal. Okay, this movie is an hour and 15 minutes long. We don't see the killer. We don't see Patient X. We don't see the face of Jason Miller until 56 minutes in.
Yeah. It was nice that it kind of had a sense of mystery without making me feel like I'm doing homework.
Well, it's very much like that. It's that rep. Cause, and we don't see, we see his face well after Kinnerman sees his face. Kinnerman sees his face and doesn't reveal, and it doesn't actually show us what he saw until a little bit later. Like, they even build towards that. There is always there's always this tease, the teasing out of what, of this horror of Kinnerman reacting to seeing this face. He's like, yes, I recognize that man. He was a friend of mine. He died 15 years ago and now he's in that cell. And let's talk about those scenes. Let's talk about those lovely conversations with Jason Miller / Brad Dourif / Legion.
Yeah, well, okay, so first of all, I have to admit that my suspected face blindness, I did have to rewind a few times. I was like, wait, that's a different man.
It is a different man, yes.
It took me. Also, I just might be stupid.
Well, the film does not hold your, it is not like spell out. There is certainly a lot of exposition, especially in those scenes in particular. But it is still not like super handholdy about what these things mean. Like, especially with who Brad Dourif is. Brad Dourif was the Gemini killer. And you see that, you see that in a folder, that like, it's never like, it's never said like, cause he doesn't see Brad Dourif's face. He sees his friend's face. He sees, Father Karras's face. It's Jason Miller. But the entity that's inside of him is the Gemini killer, who is Brad Dourif.
Yeah, which isn't super straightforward.
No, and it's not.
I was enjoying myself, not fully understanding that at the time.
Well, I mean,
which is the strength of the movie.
Yeah, he explains it to a certain, like, he's like, yeah, your father died, and I just slipped right in. The Master. And he references the Master, which is that Satan? Is that like the big capital Lucifer? Is that like the head devil, or is that just a devil? We don't know. There's like the demon that's in the original Exorcist is also present. Like, there is that they reference the Legion in particular, because it feels like there's at any time different demons popping in and out of Father Karras's body.
Oh.
And riding him around a little bit.
Yeah. And lighten up his brainwaves.
I think it's fascinating that they like say like, oh yeah, he was kind of brain dead for a long time, and we had to basically rehabilitate him so that he could move around and talk.
Well, and also every time he takes a nap, he's like hibernating. You'd think somebody would be on that case. It just seems like, oh yeah, that's just a weird thing he does.
I mean, it's again faith in institutions, Yusuf. Faith in medicine.
Somebody would be on that case, though. Somebody would be writing about that in the Journal of New England Medicine such thing.
When you're confronted with the impossible, or when you're confronted with face-to-face with evil, capital E evil.
Yes.
That cannot be explained, what do you do?
I drank a lot of Sanka and just generally stress out.
That's George C. Scott.
I solved the case.
That's George C. Scott's answer. That's Kinnerman's answer. But I mean, that is what the movie is asking us. It's like, well, what is medicine going to do when it's going to, oh yeah, there's this guy, he's comatose sometimes, his brain waves change and they're really weird. And we don't know why. What are you going to tell? Oh yeah, I wrote a paper. Yeah, he possesses comatose people in the other ward. And then he goes and commits horrific murders with them.
Yeah, I guess saying it out loud, I probably would find a way to sort of coexist without thinking about that too much. Be like, well, he gets real sleepy. It's fine.
I mean, he was completely gone for 15 years and then he returns. And you're like, well, okay. Sure, this detective has pieced together that he has reappeared exactly the moment the Gemini killers has become awakening again, and the Gemini killer was killed 15 years ago, and you know, it's all this weird creepy stuff is all coincidentally happening at the same time, but science doesn't back this up.
Wait, okay, so I'm sure I missed this, but patient X,
yeah,
where did he come from?
Is the body of the dead priest from the original Exorcist.
Okay, so it's the body. The body came back to life.
Yes, and he's still in there.
We should probably like put him somewhere, take care of him.
He had no identification, and he was kind of like in out of it basically. And you're like, well, you know, you take this poor soul and you just put him in this ward for comatose people. And he wasn't in the cell for a long time. He was out with the general public for most of the time. But then when he woke up, he became violent, so they locked him up.
Okay. So how does George C. Scott find out about him?
The demon made sure he did. That's what I'm saying. George C. Scott didn't figure that out. The demon sent a message through the hospital administrator, the psychiatric ward administrator, the guy who kills himself.
Mm. The demon,
you know, basically orchestrated all this. He orchestrated, I want Kinnerman to come back because I remember Kinnerman was involved in the Gemini Killer case. I want Kinnerman back in here. I want to talk to him. I want to rub it in his face that his friend now is being used. I want publicity. You know, the Gemini Killer himself's like, tell him that it was the Gemini Killer and tell him I'm back.
I love that there's so many different parallel agendas going on in this possessed man.
Yeah.
You know, which that's cool. That's fun. I mean, because really what's more evil than a lack of unity in your insane murderous demons?
Well, I mean, it's all about like, well, yeah, I want to inflict as much pain as possible on people.
Yeah, I like that he was like kind of complaining about being executed because he was like, I had so many more people I wanted to kill. What the what, guys?
I did not appreciate the execution. Brad Dourif is incredible. I want to say that as well. His performance is so much fun. He always plays a crazy person.
Yeah, well, you know.
Brad Dourif routinely just always is a playing someone who's probably a nutcase. Generally is playing a nutcase. It was Jack Nicholson, Insane Asylum movie. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, which I just watched again.
That's where he first made his name, and despite the fact that he has a lot of range, that's largely what he has played for his entire career, is these.
Yeah.
I was watching an X-Files episode where he plays a killer, again, another serial killer. And an incredible job. He is just a tremendous actor with a part that could easily be very... And I think that's the other thing. Like, this could easily flip over into camp.
Yeah, and it really doesn't. I mean, it doesn't take itself too seriously where it's like, this is serious cinema where we're like telling you about the world of philosophy and stuff, smart stuff. It's just a movie. It is just what it is.
Go ahead.
It's enjoyable. I enjoy it just for what it is.
I mean, it is that kind of hard-boiled detective story, but it just happens to be the case they're solving is one of a demon and of a thing where like you when you juxtapose that type of story shape of detective story and we're gonna get our guy and it will work out, and then you're like, oh well, you can't arrest a demon.
Yeah, the ending is grim.
Well, let's talk about the ending we got here. Okay. The ending is part of the extensive reshoots.
Okay.
Here the original ending is basically Kinnerman walks in, guns him down. No exorcism, no dark powers, just walks in, shoots him a bunch, like three or four times, pow, 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 dead. An execution. That's all that it is.
Okay. Was that the ending in the novel?
I think so. I think it is. It's largely the same. It's a little, there's also more, I think, background information about the Gemini Killer and other stuff that kind of got omitted along the way, I think, to make the screenplay, the film a little bit, you know. Here's the story, is that William Peter Blatty made his version, which I think is represented relatively closely by the director's cut. And then the studio gave him an option. They said, you can leave the film as it is and then give it to us and we will make the changes we want. Which would include, we want an exorcism. You know, we want, the movie's called Exorcist 3.
The third, we maybe want three exorcisms.
Yeah, we want an exorcism. People are going to see Exorcist 3. They're expecting an exorcism. You know, if there's no exorcism, they're going to be like, what is this film? So we want an exorcism. And if you don't do what we want, you can just say, this is my version. Give it. And we'll take it and make it the film we want. We'll give it to someone else. We will have reshoots by, and William Peter Blatty opted, like, well, if they're going to change it anyway, I'd rather I be in control of those changes versus some other director. So he, and the largest of the changes is the sending, where we get an exorcism. We get a different father, different Father Mourning, who's the blonde haired reverend, who's There's a reason all those scenes that are that he is in up to that moment are entirely disconnected from the rest of the film because those are all reshoots.
Okay, that makes sense. It was sort of weird that, like, when the old lady dressed up like the nurse was in George C. Scott's house, father shows up and he's like, kicks open the door and he's like, it's exorcism time. Like, he's practically like playing air guitar.
Yeah, it is.
The timing was weird. I was like, wait, how's this happening? Well,
they want an exorcism. The studio want an exorcism. So, and Blatty was like, that final scenes with the new reverend, the new priest, and the new ending with George C. Scott is incredibly different from the rest of the film.
It is. I mean, it's fun.
It's a lot of fun. It's full on Phantasmagoria.
I don't hate it.
Full on Phantasmagoria. Just snakes coming out of the ground. The priest gets his face ripped off by the force of the devil.
Yes.
There's a light from God that shines down on a cross that the priest has, and he uses it to stop the demon and we get
some snakes.
There's snakes rising, and all the dead people also rising out of this hole in the ground that are crucified, and the terrible imagery.
I did like that hole in the ground. That was cool. Like, that was very Hellraiser.
It is.
I enjoyed that.
There's a lot of Hellraiser in that scene. I mean, it looks great. I think that says a lot to Blatty and his ability to do something different when pressed. You know, like, this is what the studio wants. That's what I'll give them what they want. You know, but I'm gonna.
And
do
what
it.
Was cool is, like, that room always felt like a room, even though it felt like a very large room. I don't know. Maybe that doesn't make sense, but I like the scene, like the setting of it. The set. That's the word. That's the movie lingo I was looking for. I think it's a good set.
Well, it's very theatrical, like theater, stage.
Yeah, it was cool. I felt like, man, there was really a hole. I could fall in that hole.
And then we get that incredible monologue by George C. Scott about evil and what he believes in.
Almost as good as the thing about the fish.
We haven't mentioned the fish, but oh my god, the carp. That's a great. If I see it swimming, I'll kill it.
Yeah,
he's right on edge. He's like this lovely. He's like, oh, it's a lovely fish. It's a tasty fish. I've got nothing against it. He's like, if I see it awake, I'll kill it. And the father can't hold it together. He's laughing at his friend talking about how he's gonna murder this fish. And you're like, okay.
To be fair. It's swimming up and down his bathtub.
I like, know. That yeah. is, He's like, I that can't.
Is that what yeah. does with a carp? How big is this?
Carps are big. Carps are big fish. It's been swimming. God.
I'm looking at the internet. They're a big carp.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had a bath for 3 days. I can't go home. It's just so good. But then the evil, I believe in murder. I believe in pain. And you're like, oh, God, George C. Scott, man, is just selling. I believe in you. And it's just this, you still refuses to acknowledge God. It is just, I believe
sticks in. Sticks to his guns. I believe in Sanka. I believe in indigestion.
Believe in slime.
I must be leaving.
Believe in infidelity.
Oh, yeah, that was weird. That was a weird one to throw in. It was like, wait, what? Like,
I mean, it's just
airing grievances here.
I mean, he's just like awful, terrible. Every awful, terrible thing that he's probably witnessed as a cop over the years.
Yeah, yeah, that is him breaking.
I don't know. Have you noticed all the racism in this that he calls out specifically?
No.
I guess. It's little moments here and there. It's like right at the very beginning of when we first see Kinnerman and he's in the police station and he's calling out the detectives. He's like, "You're a racist, Ryan," or something like that.
Oh, I vaguely remember that. I think I was just distracted by when he said that Macbeth was a play about the numbing of the moral sense. I was like, what?
I mean, that's another reference to this is like how, you know, everyone else, he is not letting himself be numbed. You know, he is feeling all of this. He lets those impacts of all this terribleness hit him, you know, and I think that's an allusion to that. But he's like, you're a racist, Ryan. And like, because he, like, they, I think they use the race slur later on. His mother-in-law is anti-Semitic.
Yes. Yeah, I do remember that.
His mother-in-law's, they're all crazy. And you're like, what? Okay. And it's just like another, again, he's like, it's corruption. And it's not just corruption. It's corruption of one, the police force. It's corruption of this, of, again, the elderly. And they're, and like, there's a lot of interactions with old people in this, with, because they're easily influenced, the old and the comatose.
Yes. That's been my experience.
But that's, again, it's just exemplified by that final speech.
Yes,
but you look at the director's cut and it's kind of, it's very plain, and it's kind of, it's a little too, and like the whole movie is kind of plain, but the way
so,
that it's
okay,
the way
so
that
the director's cut still doesn't just end with him shooting the devil.
No, yeah, that's how it ends.
That's how it ends.
Yeah, as far as I know.
Okay, so but there's still the speech.
No speech.
He just comes in. He's like, okay, but okay, was there the exorcism?
No exorcism. He just kills Father. He kills Father Karras.
The room's clean, no hole in the bottom.
No hole in the ground.
Bang, bang, bang. Credits.
Father Karras is dead. I think he still stands over Karras' grave. But, you know, his friend has been set free, basically.
How is it that he wouldn't be in jail for shooting a defenseless mental patient?
I mean, he does it anyway, and he doesn't go to jail in this version of Yousef, so.
Yeah, but like in this version, there's like priest brains everywhere.
And here, I'm going to give you an answer that in 2020 is very relevant. He's a policeman.
I grimly accept that explanation.
Yeah, it's really easy. Boy. It's an easy answer. He's a cop. They let him. He just says, I needed to. And they go, okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's fine.
That's fine.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, man. That just makes me want to take a shower.
I'm very sorry. I mean, that the film itself does kind of do that.
Yeah.
It's kind of...
No, my last note was, what a grim ending.
Yeah, he kills... And that's a victory, sort of, is that he gets to kill his best friend, or a best friend of his. That has been trapped.
Number one, a best friend.
Yeah. Father Karras has been... trapped inside his own body, that's the demon is taking control, or the Gemini killer is taking control of him over for 15 years, and finally, and you see these little peaks of Father Karras, like he emerges for a second, even the demon at times takes advantage of that. He's like, ha, I tricked you. It's not Father, I'm not, it's still me. But the victory is that he shoots his best friend in the head and sets him free.
Yeah, it is, I feel like Pixar was influenced a lot by this film.
No.
In the way that they treat the people that watch their films.
They rip out your heart?
Yeah, they rip out your heart. I'm afraid to watch Cars because I'm afraid that it will make me feel something.
Don't worry about that.
Oh, it's a safe one.
It's a safe, you can watch Cars without having too much attachment.
Yeah.
It's all right. So that's, and that, you know, Father Mourning and I don't know if Father Mourning survives. He did get like his body ripped apart. I don't know if he's okay after that, but.
Which one was Father Mourning?
That was the final priest. That was the priest of the final exorcism.
I thought he got his face ripped off.
He does, but he's alive. He wakes up to cast out the Gemini killers or the demon. Whichever, or the master, I forget who's, I don't know who's possessing the body at that point, but he casts him out long enough for Kinderman to kill Father Karras.
Maybe he makes it, and I need to believe that that's why Kinderman isn't put in the hut. Need to believe that it was a testimony.
Oh my god, that guy, I did not recognize him at all. Did he pass away? Is that? Yeah. Oh, well, no, he stopped. He just stopped. He must have just done theater after it. After a while. Because he doesn't have that. The gentleman who plays Father Mourning is a character in Spawn, the 1997 Spawn film, which I have a very soft spot in my heart for.
And our next, no, oh god, I did not see the Spawn.
It's
although
our,
I did it, like.
It's not good, but it's interesting. I know the comics are terrible. Don't.
I liked them when I read half of one that one of my friends had after it came out, like at the time.
That sounds like it. But he was a character. He was nearly unrecognizable in Spawn. I'm assuming he just did theater for a long time. I did not recognize it in him. He's looked very different. That's interesting. But there is that. There is the. It is. I don't know. That ending is very different than the rest of the film, but it's still very pleasing, even if it is very tonally different. I don't mind it, and I might watch that director's cut at some point just to see the differences. But from what I have seen, the clips, it might just be a product of, oh, it's unfinished footage, and maybe there are other camera angles, but it's a flat, wide shot when they do the execution. It doesn't look very artistic. Maybe that's the problem. It's that's the only footage they had is this test footage or something. They also redressed that room. Basically, they reshot a lot of what happened in that room in the padded cell. It was formerly just brick, and they made it padded. You know, they flavored it up a little bit.
It was a very tall room. High ceilings, vaulted ceilings.
How do you feel about those scenes with the elderly ladies crawling on the ceiling?
It's silly, but I kind of love it. It was just fun. It was a nice detail. It was very, very satanic.
Well,
spidery, right?
Yes, there is that.
But nobody noticed. I feel like somebody would have noticed, and there was that. But you know who probably would have noticed is that lady who was comatose or whatever on the couch looking up at the ceiling. You'd think she would have freaked out if I had written this.
Oh.
William, Billy Bubby. Missed opportunity. She freaks out. The nurses are don't even notice. They just drug her up. You could have had some real commentary.
I think they're just out of it at that point. Most of those people in that psychiatric ward don't know they're not aware of anything that's happening.
They're used to people on the ceiling.
Well, how often do you look up, Yusuf?
All the time.
You don't. That's not true. You never. How often do you look at your own ceiling?
A lot, actually. I have a lovely ceiling.
Okay. I'm just most. And when you're out in public, do you look up at the ceiling a lot?
I do.
No, you actually. Don't. Don't lie to me.
I do. I've always looked at ceilings.
You're such a liar. I always look at ceilings.
I feel like you have enough empirical evidence about me to know that that is probably true.
I don't know. I don't trust you.
And I feel like it's probably true.
I want to talk about the hallway scene.
Yeah.
Because I think it is a focal point of the film, and is this long scene where it is just this slow, like it's weird, slow, strange, weird tension.
It's the most like classic like horror movie of that era kind of scene. Like it has those trappings to it.
Yeah, it is like
fun.
No, it's extraordinarily well executed, and it also doesn't rely on gore. It is, you know, you're just a nurse. Then you're following this nurse around, and you get this early jump scare by some patient. And she's worked up about it, but then but she leaves that room, and we just get the shot of this long hallway with the nurse station at the end, and it just holds there for a while, for a couple minutes, and you know a lot of the time I think jump scares are cheap.
Well, I feel like you get one. I feel like that's appropriate. It's like if you get your one. It's like your F-bombs, you get like a certain number.
I don't mind them as long as they're earned.
Sure.
And I feel like that's what that shot does. It's like it just holds on this long hallway, and you just see the nurse kind of walk around and just having like date, like, yeah, I was doing, oh yeah, I'm a little worked up, I just got scared and a little jumpy. And the security guard, you see the security guard change shifts or something, mm-hmm. and you're just like, and it just keeps going, and you're like, okay, I'm waiting for something. And the whole film up to this point, again, this is well before the finale, is all very calm and grounded. You don't get a lot of camera movement. So you're just kind of like, okay, I guess I don't know what we're waiting for.
I mean, I felt like we knew what we were waiting for, but it happened in a way we were not waiting for it to have happened.
Well, you mean a person dressed like a nurse just suddenly springs out from the side of the hallway with giant shears? God, those shears.
That was... I really like that was like such a Law and Order thing too, when they were like, you know, like,
how do they work?
And you know, like, he's like, oh, these are, you know, rusty or whatever.
They're a little, you know, they catch a little bit, you know.
Yeah, and like a good detective, he's like, wait, they're new. What about the old ones? You know, so that was good. That was a nice little bit. I like that a lot. I like the. You know, the them being in the morgue and the slightly off, you know, pathologist? Is that the word?
Sure. Yeah.
They seem to be telling the truth.
It's just again, it's cold, it's very clinical. It's very like,
yeah.
Here, this is, look at this, you could use these shears. And we get that, like, very much, we see them demonstrated that one time, and then we get that long hallway scene where we don't actually see them work, but we see this figure emerge flowing white behind them, and then the screaming, terrible screaming sound, like it's unearthly, like, I don't know what sound that is with it.
I can assume that was, like, her terror, because obviously he didn't decapitate her there, because that would have been a mess. And he's very fastidious.
Well, I mean, I think, I don't know, you could have easily, I don't think it was necessarily every time has to be neat and clean. I think certain cases he wants to make them
neat. Oh, that makes sense.
He is an artist, all right? Every single kill is different, you know?
True.
I've got to hold up the body. I hold up the head and let them see.
And I do love his perfectionist tendencies. He's like, yes, a little is wasted, I will admit, but the effect is good.
God, it's so...
You gotta respect a craftsman.
The close-up with his mouth, and he's like... Ugh. I'm alive! I breathe! I live! The outbursts.
The funniest thing, and this is legitimately funny... It's picturing him, like, regenerating the guy's brain cells. And just, he's, like, kind of complaining about it. He's like, it took forever. Which is just very funny to me. I always like the idea of, like villains, like, shopping for, like, their costumes and, like, stuff that they put in their lairs. So, like, that kind of tickled that for me.
There is that level of, again, I don't know, everyday... tedium? They still exist in this world, even with this fantastical stuff going on.
Absolutely. Satan is everywhere.
Well, and then we get the scene where the confrontation, where he sends one of the elderly patients disguised as a nurse to Kinderman's house.
Which, why did they let this woman in?
Again, Yusuf, I'm gonna come right back to it. She's a nurse. Trust, faith in institutions.
Okay, so, Robbie.
Yeah.
You get a knock at your door.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you have a fancy doorbell and it tells you in the app. I don't know your life.
I don't have... there's no Ring apps in 1990, so I don't think that's a concern.
Okay, fair enough. The best you would get would be like a fancy song played?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like a MIDI kind of thing. But anyway...
Why do birds suddenly appear?
Absolutely.
That's a Simpsons reference for you, Yusuf.
Oh, is it?
Yep. Senor Ding Dong.
Oh, you see, I was thinking about the soundtrack to My Best Friend's Wedding.
I don't know that.
It's a soundtrack that I've listened to a lot.
I don't know why. Why would you do that?
It's a pretty good soundtrack. I mean, the film, not great, but the soundtrack's really good.
Okay, what were your original point? Lady at the door.
A lady at the door. Thank you. You're very good at talking. So lady at the door knocks on the door, dressed up as a nurse, 1,000 years old. She's not getting in. I'm not buying those magazines. I am not subscribing to that. There's no pizza in her hands. There is no exchange.
Well, did you not catch the ruse?
She said she was there for some medical business, right?
No, prior to that. Prior to her arrival.
Yeah.
The demon calls Kinderman's wife and tells her in Kinderman's voice, there's a nurse coming soon. Let her in. You know, let her in.
Oh.
Because they
feel like that'd be a conversation, but maybe that's a thing he does. He likes to have the nurse come.
Well, they have a juxtaposition of Kinderman on the phone trying to get in touch with his wife, and it's busy. And then you see her talking on the phone, and she's referencing him, like she's talking to him, and it's like, well, who's she talking to? That sounds just like her husband, and yet her husband's not on the phone with her. Oh, it's the demon. And he has impersonated voices multiple times so far in the film.
Also, it does track that Kinderman wouldn't really be a fan of call waiting.
No.
Like, which you would have to pay for at this time.
No, Kinderman's just, and like, I mean, he's very kind and soft with his family. I think that's a nice touch as well.
He's, but I feel like the concept of call waiting, like he would just like be sort of like cranky about it. He'd be like, well, you know, I'm not going to pay the phone company to tell me that two people are calling. I only want to talk to one person at a time. And the priest would be like, oh, it's actually very useful, you know, etc. That's all. But overall, he's a nice man.
But I mean, I think that's her husband called and told her that a nurse is coming over. And you would go, okay, well, it's weird that she's so old. And she says that as soon as he comes home. She's like, what's with her? Why is she like, she's acting all weird. And he's like, what do you mean? A nurse? What are you talking about? And she's kind of out, and you can tell that she is a little bit, she's coming to the surface a little bit, because she's like, please help me.
She's waking up.
And she's like, this is her. And she, you know, she's just some poor lady who is probably senile. And she's like, help. I don't know where I'm at. I don't know what's happening. And then
was
suddenly
she the radio lady.
No, this is a different lady. Every time it was a different woman.
I like the radio lady.
She was, yeah. I mean, it's, again, it's just these old ladies who are otherwise helpless. And yep. That's who the demon uses. He takes advantage of these people. He wants to. It's the easiest path. And it causes the most chaos, because you don't expect these people to be the source of violence. But then he almost nearly decapitates Kinderman's daughter.
Yeah, I was astounded that she got away without so much as a scratch.
It was a close call.
See, I feel like if this were a modern film of the modern era, she would have like there would have been a scene with her with like a Band-Aid around her neck or something.
I mean, I would assume that she would just be killed. But I think that is the restraint the film has, is that it does not kill her. Because there's a lot of other deaths in this film, a lot of really gruesome stuff.
But it doesn't feel like too many.
No, I think that is exactly the right amount. I think that
it was like less than 10.
I mean, it's not necessarily the number of deaths, Yosef. It's kind of just the gruesome
the motion of the deaths in the ocean.
I don't know the size of the death. You could stop that analogy. You don't need to do that.
I was just trying to explain it for our listeners.
You're doing a very poor job.
Okay.
And it hurt me to hear you.
They will send you letters.
No, they won't. I know what will happen. That is not true.
You won't let them in, but some of those letters.
I also would say that
enveloped in elderly nurses.
I think it is also a point earlier. I feel like there's a lot more. I think there's more people now who are like don't answer. Like, you know, I don't answer the door for anyone who is not. I am not aware they're coming. I don't care what you're doing. You can knock on my door. You can ring my doorbell 100 times. I'm not opening the door. I'm not talking to you. I don't know who you are. I don't know why you're here. You're just telling me something or whatever reason. I don't want to talk to you. I'm not going to answer the door. I feel like
I engage with those people. I don't like talk to them too long, but I do tell them that I'm good with whatever service I have.
Oh no, I don't do that. I let it be just empty silence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have an appointment with you. Why are you at my door? I do not have to give you my attention.
That's a fair point.
I have a finite amount of it. I decide who gets it and you don't.
You are the master of your own ship.
Sure. But, I mean, it's also, I think, this is 1990.
Yeah, and people still answered the door.
People were nicer, I think.
Randos
at the door, at least if it's a lady dressed up like a nurse, even if she looks a little old and she's out of it. You'd think you'd still be like, oh, my husband called. Sure, she looks a little weird, but whatever.
In 100 years, will we even have doors, like, to not answer?
I hope so. I don't know how else am I getting in my house?
You're there. You're already there.
I don't think
they build it around you.
Teleportation is not achievable.
No, they build it around you like a terrarium.
I don't ever leave.
No,
I don't like that either.
Well,
I mean, 100 years from now, I'll be dead, so it doesn't matter. I'm not living. I'm certainly not living at 135. That's not going to happen. But I feel like the daughter survives, and so does Kinderman, and I think that feels appropriate. It feels that final showdown does, I think, put a good cap on, like, all that is earned.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's not like this overextended, giant metaphor commentary on anything. That the movie just kind of ends, and it's kind of a bummer, and I mean, I guess there's conclusions you can draw about whatever. But yeah, it's the movie very much, for the most part, stays in its lane of like what it is. And it's just like a fun kind of,
I would call it tense. Fun.
It is fun.
Is it?
It's fun to watch George C. Scott talk about that damn fish in his bathtub. That's great.
Early on it's fun. I think at a certain, when Dyer dies, I think the film turns the corner.
Yeah, but then it's even fun to him like talking in like the insane asylum padded cell with the guy, you know, and the voice is modulating, like that's fun. It's fun when there's a big hole in the floor. It's fun when the guy's head gets peeled off. These are fun horror movie things.
It's the smiles that keep us going.
It's true. Oh my gosh, this movie was just a delight.
It is captivating.
Yeah,
I think that's the thing, that it was just like, I'm just stuck. I'm just glued to the screen. I'm just like, I need to know the performances, the writing, the direction, the sound design. It all works really well, works beautifully.
I mean, it's not a perfect film.
No.
It's not like,
but I mean,
oh my God, but it's so much better than it has any right to be, which is refreshing. When you suggested, oh yeah, we're going to watch Exorcist 3. I'm like, what happens in Exorcist 3? Like, where, like, how does this train wreck? Because, like, why would you watch Exorcist 3? But it was a delightful surprise. Not like that Hereditary.
You're still holding on.
I'm still upset about that. Speaking of decapitation,
oof.
Have a little class, guys.
I mean, I think, I don't know.
They should have watched Exorcist 3.
I think Hereditary has, there's some similarities.
Yeah?
Yeah, to Hereditary. I think they're both very restrained, and they're heavily focused on dialogue, and I think Hereditary is actually closest to Exorcist than to Exorcist 3, but I think they all share similarities. They share DNA.
There are people on the ceiling in Hereditary, right?
That is also another thing. That is a similar scene with Toni Collette. Also, yeah. Does go up on the ceiling, and it's again like it's just like this weird, like suddenly the film turns a corner and like this crazy stuff's happening when most of the film has been very reserved and grounded and about families yelling at each other.
Yeah, that movie does ramp up. It's like it starts out and you're like, oh, it's the squid and the whale, and you're like, no, it's Moby Dick. Like it's out of control. So I will say, having watched Hereditary and processed it, I enjoy it after the fact, but at the time, not good. Not a good experience.
I mean, it's unpleasant. I think that's also the difference between Hereditary is a thing you have to, I feel like, I knowing, I now that I've watched it, I feel like going, if I was going to watch it again, I'd have to be like ready for it. I'd have to steel myself knowing that it was going to be an unpleasant experience.
It's like when you go to the dentist and like you need to get like a filling or something, and they have to like inject your gums. You're like, you know that you have survived this and that it's not super the worst thing, but you're like, So yeah, I probably will not elect to watch Hereditary again. However, I will happily watch Exorcist 3 again.
I mean, I think that that's, again, this is, again, it's that I think it fills that nice little spot in the kind of spectrum of horror films where it has a lot of variety in it. It's different from a lot of other horror films, and it's not very splashy. It is not in, except for the finale, it is kind of very reserved for the most part, and it has not crossed that threshold that I think Hereditary does, where it's truly just unpleasant. Where I think Hereditary is kind of a masterpiece in that it makes you feel that way, it evokes that feeling, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's something I want to experience all the time. Well, this film is just like just before it, where I could rewatch this again and again and still kind of just get it, pull from the performances, pull from the writing, and kind of and enjoy it. It's enjoyable.
Yeah. Kind of like every so often I'll rewatch Hellraiser.
Oh, Hellraiser's great. I love Hellraiser.
Hellraiser's great. Some of those sequels, though, those are...
Hellraiser 1's great. Hellraiser 2, better than Hellraiser.
Okay.
That's my big
happens in Hellraiser 2? Is that the one with the artist and the...
No. Hellraiser 2 is where the original girl's in an insane asylum, and she goes back, and they have to stop.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good. I like that.
Hellraiser 2 is great. I think it's better than Hellraiser 1. Hellraiser 3 is bad, but campy. It's like, they get a whole new team of Cenobites, and all of them are built around like audio visual equipment. One is a CD player man, one is a camera demon. Like, it's all very, very silly.
Wait, I don't think I've seen Hellraiser 3. I think I've only seen Hellraiser 2, because Hellraiser 2, they go to hell.
Yes, Hellraiser 2 is in hell. Hellraiser 3 is on Earth. It's Hell on Earth is the literal title of Hellraiser 3.
You know, funny thing about Hellraiser, one of my neighbors has like a Cenobite tattoo, and I was like, oh, cool Cenobite tattoo. And he was like, what are you talking about? I was like, you know, on your arm? He's like, oh yeah, I went to this like festival and in the Netherlands one time.
Oh.
And like they had these guys from this movie, and like I liked it, so I got the tattoo. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Oh no. Oh,
he's
no.
A really nice guy. He's a super nice guy.
I'm sure he's
but
lovely.
I felt like I was just like, oh, you know, do I say like nice Hellraiser tattoo? No, I'm going to say like nice Cenobite tattoo. So this guy knows that like I'm down, like I get it. He's like, what are you talking about? It was like being 12 years old all over again.
I'm sure he's a lovely man. I would not get a tattoo from him.
He's a very nice man, but yeah, that's
I would not get a tattoo from a movie franchise I'm unfamiliar with. Hellraiser 3 is campy. Is campy fun? It's bad, but it's bad. Hellraiser 4 also bad, but almost half good. It's a very strange film. It also is a what's the name? The director name people use when they don't want to put their real name on the thing? Alan Smithy. It's an Alan Smithy joint in that the original director backed out, I think, at some point. But
does one of them happen in space?
That is 4. 4 is half in space and half in the present day.
I feel like that's a thing that happened to horror movies. They were just like, okay, boldly go, let's do it.
It's also bad, but it's also enjoyable, pleasant. It also shows us the origin of the puzzle box of that. That's fun. Like, it has those fun things in it. It's not, again, it's not like a good movie. 1 and 2 are good films.
But did it come from a haunted brookstone?
No, a man in the 1700s made it, I believe, in some kind of pact with the devil. Or hell, like Cenobite demon stuff. You know, it's not. There's no real devil in.
Yeah, it's like, don't worry yourself too much about the details here.
Yeah, it's just they're Cenobites. They're trapped souls that are made into demons of a sort.
And one of them is a CD player.
In 3, yes.
Is there like a Laserdisc player that's like older and they make fun of?
No, these it's
you
like
can't actually ensnare anyone.
No, they are kind of wrangled as we like literally tele-unearthed. Like literally, there's just things we're running around. Chaos is happening. Demons are attacking. It's bad. It doesn't make it there, and they have to recruit. The old Cenobites are dead or turned good or something. Like, it's all very confusing. So we got to get new Cenobites. We want to expand the franchise. So let's get one that now the CD is like he's like a DJ, I think, and they turn him into CD Man, and he shoots CDs that are like deathly discs that cut people in half or whatever.
That sounds about as good as Highlander Endgame.
It's better than Highlander Endgame.
Is it?
Yeah. I would never watch Highlander Endgame again. I would watch Hellraiser 3 again.
High praise. Put that on the box.
I would watch this film again eventually.
See, I feel like no, you need to drag Highlander Endgame into it. It's like I would never. So the person reading the pull quote has some context for your perspective. I feel like that pull quote should have that, like a little telling detail.
I would never watch Highlander Endgame again. I would watch Hellraiser 3 again.
Absolutely.
Put that on the back of
the
box.
Or like a book review, it's like, I recycle, and I like this book.
I don't really care what you write in your review, as long as you give me 5 stars.
5 stars, baby.
Thank you. Is there anything else you want to add about Exorcist 3, Yusuf?
I like that The Exorcist sounds like Punky Brewster's dad.
Okay. I don't know what any of that. I don't. That sentence is a form. That's the Yahoo Serious Festival over here. I don't know what those words mean together, but.
Oh, well, Punky Brewster's dad had like kind of like a milk voice. He was like, Punker. And The Exorcist kind of has that milk voice thing going on. You know, like he drank a lot of milk, like on a hot day, like after like playing field hockey or something. I don't know. I was an inside kid. I didn't do any of that.
It's just a whirlwind. Every time you open your mouth, Yusuf, I don't know what I'm going to get. And it's just. I've never watched Punky Brewster in my entire
really?
Life. Why would I?
I think that it's about this like street urchin who like
I know what it, old man. I know what it is. I don't
She's
know why
a lovable well, scamp.
Why would I watch that?
Why? Because why would you have not have watched it?
It was never on television ever.
Well,
I watched The Simpsons. I think that's very clear.
Okay. Yeah,
I watched The Simpsons and I Love Lucy.
You watched I Love Lucy?
Yeah, Nick at Night.
Oh, God. Nick at Night was just like, I think that's how they got kids who had cable to go to bed.
I loved I Love Lucy.
I was just like, I hate that horse.
Well, you don't watch Mr. Ed. What are you doing?
The only thing worse than Mr. Ed was just that sort of high, lonesome boredom sound of the Lassie theme song.
Nick at Night was great because you got I Love Lucy, Dick Van Dyke, I Dream of Jeannie.
I liked I Dream of Jeannie.
Taxi?
Taxi was good.
Taxi is not good. Taxi is great.
Yeah, Taxi. I like Taxi.
Welcome Back,
People
Cotter.
People in their messy lives. I did like Welcome Back, Cotter.
Great. Best theme song in television history.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty good. Taxi back. Has a pretty good theme song.
Taxi is good, too. But there's there's no lyrics to Taxi, though, I think. It's just
yeah.
It's just instrumental. Welcome
Can
Back.
Did I ever tell you about Smooth Jazz?
Yes.
Because, like, Bob James, did I tell you about that?
I don't know. You've told me lots of anecdotes about Smooth Jazz and the guy who used to own the record store that you worked at.
Okay, very good. Well, Bob James's record covers have clever visual puns. That is what I will say.
Good to know. Yusuf, is there anything you'd like to plug before we go?
I would like you to listen to my Dungeon Synth album. That I did with a friend of mine. We're called Earth Machine. And there's apparently a subgenre of music called Dungeon Synth.
Yeah.
And we've written the perfect Dungeon Synth album. And it's not even an album. It's an EP. It's even better. It's called Clad in a Forest of Dark Fur.
What does EP stand for?
It's Excellent Product.
Okay, good.
Yeah. That's what it is. That's why we call it an EP, because it's excellent.
Earth Machine is the band?
Earthmachinemusic.bandcamp.com. Because if you go to earthmachine.bandcamp.com, it's not us. There's only one track released on August 23rd, 2019, and I listened to it once, and it I mean, no shade, but Earth Machine Music. Bandcamp.com is really where you're going to find
something
that is more dungeon synth.
Hey, Yusuf, have I ever told you how good a salesman you are?
I'm a good salesman.
You're great.
People are already buying it. They're writing me letters.
I will sell your music for you because you're terrible at it. It's a great dungeon synth album. If you are a fan of the genre, it is very good. I enjoy it. You should go check it out.
Yeah, I guess that's a better pitch.
See how easy that was? I'll post a link to that in the show notes. Yusuf, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Robbie.
Thanks again to Yusuf for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman. My website is robbiedorman.com. You'll find links there for my other podcasts and a link to purchase my horror novels, including my newest novel, War on Halloween. War on Halloween is a suspense horror story about a family fighting for Halloween in a town controlled by a sinister reverend with secret occult powers. A terrific book for some Halloween spooky reading. If you're looking for that, you can buy it now on Amazon. Read it for free with Kindle Unlimited. The show's website is serialfanasist.com, and if you like the show, please give it a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast service you use. Subscribe. Tell your friends. All that stuff helps out the show, helps me out, and I appreciate it. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.